ladies and gentlemen. Chapter 11 deals with enzyme mechanics. Enzyme mechanics, the behavior of enzymes. And apparently, our overhead is now some sort of split personality. There we go. It's now up and running, theoretically. And we finished up with this overhead number 11 that dealt with the transition state analogs, preferential binding by transition states. Let's see here. And we, our very last point that I made in a hurry was this very last comment. Non-reactive transition state analogs are potent enzyme inhibitors. And that is that you can rationally develop drugs based on information you know about enzymes that are creating disease. If an enzyme is excessively active or there's an excess amount of it being produced, you can inhibit its, permanently inhibit its activity and reduce the negative effect by purposely creating a compound whose structure or who has a part of its structure that is identical to the transition state. And when that occurs, when you can make that, because it's identical to the transition state, that compound binds very tightly to the active site. And sometimes so tightly and with a chemical reactive intermediate that actually deactivates it. So you here you see, of course, this is the trend, this is the classic illustration of the effect of enzyme transition, enzyme activity on a catalytic, based on its catalytic power. And in each case we see here, you will find that this first line right here, the top one, is simply the uncatalyzed activity that has that very high activation energy. And we know because of that high activation energy, it has a relatively low rate. But notice, if you would, that there's a variety of intermediate activation energies when an enzyme gets involved. And so let's take a look at the three different energy of activations, or little hills that have to be overcome in order for an enzyme to be active. The first here, the enzyme substrate, the first little hill right here, the first activation energy, is the energy necessary to create the enzyme substrate complex. So as the enzyme and the substrate begin to approach each other, there is changes in both the substrate and the enzyme. And those physical conformational changes cost some energy that you see right here, that little hill. But there is an energy minimum at the after the creation of that enzyme substrate complex. This is prior to the creation of the transition state. So, what then happens that this enzyme substrate immediately begins to undergo conformational, configurational change, depending on the kind of enzyme it is, and create this enzyme substrate complex that's at some sort of energy transition state. So it now begins to literally conform and change its shape, both the enzyme and the substrate, so it creates this active site, this substrate that has the same conformation as the uncatalyzed substrate, but at a much lower energy level, much lower energy of activation. It drives at this point, this thing can still go backwards or forwards, but what happens is that the concentration of the enzyme substrate is much higher than the concentration of the uncatalyzed substrate at the same transition state. Because of the energy minimum, this energy transition energy is so low, there are now many more molecules of the substrate that's at that particular transition state. And because there are more molecules that are at that transition state, there is a much greater probability that that transition state will continue forward to produce the product. That's the reason why the enzyme speeds up chemical reactions. It increases the concentration, the actual absolute number of substrates that are in the correct transition state. It increases that number dramatically, thus providing the opportunity, shall I say, to allow the substrate to move forward into the product and produce more product. All right, well then, let's just pretend then that the enzyme substrate does move forward and produce the product. You find then at the bottom here, which is not shown, you have something called an EP. If you wouldn't mind writing that in there, that would be very handy. At the very bottom of this figure 1113 on overhead number 11, there is a minimum energy on the enzyme substrate complex chart. Just before where it says E plus P, at that energy minimum, write EP. In other words, there is a time in which the product is still bound to the enzyme. There's still a time, for an instant, in which the enzyme and the product are still bound together. There's a low energy of activation that is required to separate the enzyme and the product from each other. And you see that little hillock. And then you can then produce the product and the free enzyme, which is then ready for another substrate. The small dips in the reaction coordinate system for the enzyme-catalyzed reaction arise from the binding substrate and the product to the enzyme. So as you can see there in that caption. Notice here as well on overhead number 11, it says you're supposed to skip some significant reading pages in chapter 11. And please read chapter 11 and do so if you would. Now, we're now going to look at a specific kind of... The specific classification, shall we say. This classification is not surprising, is called the serine proteases. Or is called the serine protease or serine proteases. Let's see here. There are four blanks on this page. The catalytic site, the binding. So the first blank is catalytic. The second blank is binding. The third blank is substrate. And the fourth blank is binding pocket. Binding. So we're going to use the serine protease as a paradigm for understanding some additional terminology for enzymes. The first idea here is the active site. When you look at a large enzyme, and I'm not going to draw a large enzyme because it simply looks like a ball of yarn that's been played with by a cat. You know, there's just alpha helices and beta sheets, and it can be very, very ugly looking. But nevertheless, not every location on the surface of that enzyme is where the active site exists. So you may have, it's sort of like, just as an analogy, where is the deepest spot? What is the deepest spot in the ocean at the greatest depth? What is its name and where is it located? Anybody have an idea where the deepest spot, the deepest gash on the Earth's surface, where is that? And what is it? Anybody have an idea? What? You've got the trench right. Remember what the first part of it is? Marianas Trench. That's exactly correct. And from the surface of the ocean to the depth of that trench, over 27,000 feet. It's deeper than the Mount Everest is tall. I mean, that's how far down underneath the surface that thing is. It's extremely deep, very wide. If you would remove the surface, the water off the surface of the planet, it would be easily visible through space, a deep rift, just like someone... Ever seen a golf ball that's been cut by a mishit? You haven't. I have many times. But at any rate, so it looks like with someone has just taken a ball and just sliced it with a knife and just slid it just a little bit into the surface. So, nevertheless, it's right there. And That slit is an analogy to the active site of an enzyme. You have this large globular enzyme in which only one side, one part of it, one slit, one piece is where the active site is. And that's where all the catalytic power takes place, as well as selectivity. So the active site, which is a one part of a large spherical globular protein enzyme, contains two pieces, the catalytic site and the binding site. Most classes of enzymes are designated by the kind of chemical activity that occurs at the catalytic site. They're not named or not classed by the binding site, but by the catalytic site. So at the catalytic site, there must be something having to do with a serine there. So then the binding site or binding pocket, I will use the term binding site and binding pocket interchangeably. This is where the selectivity occurs. We don't always know for certainty where it is, but it is where, remember we talked about the kinds of specificity for an enzyme, we talked about geometric specificity, we talked about stereochemical specificity. It's the stereospecific specificity is where that binding site occurs. So the stereospecific specificity and binding site go together. That's where you select what compound is going to be acted upon by that enzyme with a high level of certainty and a high level of rejection of non-appropriate substrates. So the binding site actually sort of works with the catalytic site, but it's pretty independent. So the selection criteria, whether an enzyme acts on something, is a variety of things. First of all, the binding site from the catalytic site. There will be some enzymes, if this is the binding site and this is the catalytic site, some of them are relatively far away from each other. Some of them are relatively close. And that difference in the physical distance helps select for the kind of substrate you're going to get. The shape, charge, and polarity of the substrate, and the shape, charge, and polarity of the binding pocket. Again, you want to put a little bracket right here and say stereospecific or stereochemical specificity. When you're talking about the shape, charge, and polarity, the shape, of course, that has to do with the handedness. Charge and polarity. We're going to take a look at three serine proteases. These three are going to be chymotrypsin, trypsin, and elastase. For breakfast today, I had two slices of bread with a little bit of butter and some orange juice. That's what I had for breakfast this morning. They're pretty good slices of bread. They're a very substantial bread. And of course, as you know, bread is composed of carbohydrate, but it has an important component in it that's important for its raising, and that's called gluten. And gluten is a protein material. So bread, most normal bread, has just enough protein in it to give it a good rise. When you knead a bread, you're actually creating a cross-linking of the gluten within that carbohydrate framework. That gluten then creates gas-resistant substance. Gases get trapped in that gluten-carbohydrate combination. And so when the yeast begins to act on the sugar that you add to your dough and begin, in an anaerobic sense, to produce carbon dioxide, well, hopefully not too aerobic, but anyway, to produce carbon dioxide, then that carbon dioxide is trapped by the gluten carbohydrate, and that's what causes your bread to rise. So the protein in the bread, therefore, in my stomach and in my duodenum, is currently being digested by a series of, among others, serine proteases, chymotrypsin, trypsin, and elastase. As you recall from the chart, I did not ask you to memorize, chymotrypsin, trypsin, and elastase all cleave the proteins at different locations. Especially trypsin, you recall, it breaks at lysine and arginine. Why does it break at lysine and arginine? When you look at the binding site or binding pocket, you discover at the base of that binding pocket is an aspartic acid, whose charge at pH 7 or so, pH 3 or 4, is negatively charged. That matches nicely with the positive charge of the lysine that will fit into the physical part of that pocket, into the physical size of that pocket, and therefore select for lysine and arginine, and trypsin then highly selects for that thing, and then it moves that, it then lays down this breakable bond in the other catalytic site, and the protein gets cleaved right there at lysine on the C side of lysine arginine. So the binding pocket and the active site work together. Binding pocket and the catalytic site create the active site, pardon me. So the binding site and the catalytic site work together to select for the various specificities of these enzymes. When you look at chymotrypsin, you see here that this, and this is not a mistake, well, it actually should be drawn a little differently. You see here at the bottom of this pocket is a small side chain that's fairly polar. This allows for phenylalanine, among others, to fit in there and break there at right around phenylalanine. Elastase breaks at alanine and glycine, and you can see here where the binding pocket is filled with large, bulky side chains, and thus only small side chains can fit in the binding pocket, and therefore it selects for that. So that's how the selectivity comes in. Now, what we haven't talked about is the catalytic site itself. How do they know what is the catalytic site? How do they know? How did they find that out? How did they find that out? Well, they were very, very tricky about this. And of course, the composition of the catalytic site, they had to figure out when they were working on this, they discovered that only certain amino acids were important, but which ones were important and where were they located? Well, they used some fundamental organic chemistry. They began to look at some of the side chains that could have important catalytic power. For example, do you believe that alanine as a side chain would have an opportunity to have any kind of catalysis? What is the side chain of alanine? CH3, we hear with much confidence. CH3. Now, CH3, of course, is simply a hydrocarbon. Is that correct? Is a hydrocarbon highly chemically reactive or fairly inert? It's inert, isn't it? Can you recall, going through your memorized side chains, some side chains that whose side chains are relatively chemically reactive? How about isoleucine? What's the structure for isoleucine? Is it a hydrocarbon or not a hydrocarbon? It's a hydrocarbon, yeah. What if I said phenylalanine? Phenylalanine. Do you think that's highly chemically reactive? Let's see here. It's a hydrocarbon and a benzene ring, right? Are those highly chemically reactive? Or do you have to beat on them to get things to work with it? What about serine? What's its side chain? Serine. What is its side chain? It's an OH, which is, of course, the functional group that's an alcohol. Is that fairly chemically reactive in organic chemistry? Yeah. Did you do a lot of chemistry when you were in organic chemistry with alcohols as starting groups? Yeah, you did. So they began to experiment trying to find out, was serine in fact chemically reactive? They discovered a compound called diisopropylphenylfluoridate, DIPF, would irreversibly bind to a serine. A serine. Here's the idea. And I'm going to draw this, really. I'm going to draw an ugly amino acid, ugly protein. Okay? So this is a serine protease. They didn't know it was a serine protease, but they did after this experiment. Serine protease may be had between 300 and 400 amino acids. Of those, let's say between 20 and 25 are serines. Now, where are those serines located? Well, there's a serine up here, and there's a serine over here, there's a serine right here, a serine over here, 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 serine over here. There may be 20 to 25 serines. Okay? They expose the enzyme to DIPF. Only one serine is labeled or attacked by DIPF. In other words, you may have all these serines in the protein, but only this one, they discover after breaking it apart, had that DIPF on it. Only one. One and only one. Out of the 20 or 25, only one had this DIP attached to that serine. Right. Interesting. I wonder what's going on with that serine. I wonder why just that one. Why was it just that one? Attacks one and only one specific serine out of many in the enzyme chymotrypsin. Another thing is histidine. Histidine is also a compound that is highly chemically active and shows up a lot in active sites, catalytic sites. Second catalytically important residue turned out to be discovered using a Trojan horse inhibitor, discovered that a histidine active site was important. For chymotrypsin, they used the compound TPKC. For trypsin, it was tosyl L-lysine chloromethyl ketone, which is what this is. So what happens is they take this compound called TPKC, all right, TPKC, and they exposed it to an enzyme called chymotrypsin, and it turned out that out of all the histidines in chymotrypsin, the histidine 57 gets labeled with this particular material. So there may be several other histidines, but only one, and only one gets labeled. All right, so we now have a label that can target particular and peculiar amino acid side chains. And the question is, what's going on in an enzyme that one and only one serine gets labeled and one and only one histidine gets labeled? This is how they discovered the chemistry of the active site. For the serine proteases, it's embodied in an idea called a catalytic triad. So comparing the active site structures of various serine proteases, it revealed that three amino acids are always present. Histidine, serine, and aspartic acid. Histidine, serine, and aspartic acid. So the first blank is three, the next blank is his, ser, asp, and the last blank is ser. These three amino acids, while wildly apart on the primary structure, cluster together in hydrogen bond and increase the activity of the serine side chain. So here is chymotrypsin, here's serine carboxypeptidase, and they discover that they've got a his, there's the his, the ser, and the aspartic acid. His, aspartic acid, ser, Serum, aspartic acid, HIS, they discovered that all these, while they're widely separate on the primary structure, when the enzyme folded, they were always very, very close together. I don't know if you can see this or not, but here is the classic catalytic triad in that gray area right here, where you've got a serine, a histidine, and aspartic acid. That serine, histidine, and aspartic acid, notice the numbers, they're widely separate on the primary chain, but folding them brings them very, very close together in a consistent pattern from serine protease to serine protease. Let's see what happens chemically with that. Let's see. Oh, okay, hold on. Boom, boom. Now, this is now overhead number 15, and we're looking at the catalytic triad from a chemistry mechanism point of view. From a chemistry mechanism point of view. Here we see at the top of the overhead, and please note that I am, in fact, spending quite a bit of time on this, so you can expect questions about this. Okay? You can expect questions about this. So here you have, before anything happens, you have the aspartic acid, the histidine, and the serine. The aspartic acid at physiological pH has a negative charge on its side chain. According to this model, the negative charge begins to pull on the hydrogen proton of the histidine. Whose hydrogen is attached to N1 of the nitrogen. The electrons then begin to shift. Notice here you would see here is a double bond and a single bond. Ever hear of an allylic group where the electrons can shift rapidly between one group and another, that allele thing? So these electrons begin to shift over here, which then allow these lone pair of protons to become an increasingly strong base. So the presence of this negatively charged side chain of aspartic acid pulls on the protons, allows the electrons to be distributed over this allylic form, and the lone pair electrons of the histidine then on N3 increase its nucleophilicity. Its basicity, pardon me, is a better term, and begin to pull on that hydrogen, and the electrons then of that serine begin to shift onto that oxygen. Well, as the electrons begin to shift onto that oxygen, suddenly that oxygen becomes a much stronger nucleophile. That is a nucleophile that has a negative charge. It attacks the nucleus or attacks positive charges. I want you to note right here, right next to this, it says substrate peptide. So what you've got here, your R prime and your R, is in this case not side chains. It's the rest of a long protein. A serine protease does exactly what it says it does. A protease is basically like a chopper. A guy that hands you got this long, celery. You got this big old knife, and breaks the celery up in these little chunks. That's what this serine protease has done. Here's this long protein that's trying to break apart. So this nucleophilic attack comes from the interrelationship of these three amino acids who are physically adjacent to each other. That increased nucleophile on the oxygen attacks the carbonyl backside, and you get this tetrahedral intermediate. Notice how the substrate and the enzyme are temporarily covalently bound. If you recall, I told you that one of the catalytic mechanisms was a covalent structure. So this is a covalent mechanism. So a serine protease is a mechanism that would be called covalent. So, the oxygen attacks its backside, electrons shift, and this breaks now. So now you have, instead of having one piece of protein, you have two protein fragments. This amino group leaves, water comes in, And as water, it begins to reestablish the equilibrium. Again, the hydrogen gets pulled away. The oxygen attacks this tetrahedral intermediate backside. Well, you guys, not backside, but it creates a backside attack that breaks that serine oxygen, the carbonyl oxygen bond. These electrons shift. Water comes in. Here's that second fragment of peptide that's now released. And you finally now have the restored catalytic triad. So the catalytic triad is now restored and ready to accept another protein fragment to be broken apart. So what's happening currently in my gut in the duodenum is that serine proteases, chymotrypsin, elastases, other serine proteases are acting on the gluten that I ate with the bread and breaking it apart into amino acids that are being brought into my body. That's what does, and then the amino acids are the building block. So whenever you eat, if you eat cow meat, for example, the body doesn't take the cow muscle and say, oh, you're a cow muscle, I'm going to import you entirely and then put you into a muscle location here, and then you become part human muscle and part cow muscle. No, it breaks it down completely. So proteins get broken down into amino acids. Carbohydrates get broken down into monosaccharides. Fats get broken down into fatty acids. And then they get brought into the body and then restored completely. So this is called a serine protease mechanism. One of the questions I like to ask is, what I've done is I've separated these out and I asked you to put them in order. One of the questions I'm likely to ask, although not guaranteed, it depends from year to year, is to take this and put this in the correct order of occurrence on a test. All right. Now, this is taken directly from this book because I couldn't say it any better. So I apologize for that, but it is what it is. This is another important aspect, is that the binding site and active site have conformations, configurations that anticipate the structure of the transition state. This preferential partial binding of the transition state or tetrahedral intermediate over the enzyme substrate complex or the acyl enzyme intermediate is responsible for much of the catalytic efficiency of serine proteases. Thus, mutating any or all the residues in the chymotrypsin's catalytic triad yields enzymes that still enhance proteolysis over the uncatalyzed reaction rate for the native enzyme. Similarly, the reason that DPIF is such an effective inhibitor of serine proteases is because its tetrahedral phosphate group makes this compound a transition state analog. Notice here, if you would, here is chymotrypsin. Here's the binding pocket that favors phenylalanine as a binding preferentially. And here is the, in red, or in block lines, is the protein that's about ready to be cleaved. This next step illustrates the transition state, in which the carbonyl group has now been formed as a tetrahedral carbon. And notice there is a physical region within the binding pocket called an oxyanion hole that's there in preparation of accepting this temporary intermediate, this negatively charged intermediate, this transition state intermediate. So this is the classic transition state for a serine protease. This DIPF already has that shape and therefore binds very powerfully into that pocket, because it already has the transition state shape. And because it covalently links with that serine on a permanent status, it then kills the enzyme and is permanently bound to that serine. All right. So, notice here that this oxyanion hole is there, even though under normal circumstances that transition state exists only for a few microseconds. So here we are asked to believe in biochemical evolution that this pocket was developed over the eons, I guess, even though what it accepts, the piece of what it accepts, exists only for microseconds at a time. And we're supposed to believe that those microseconds were favored by an oxyanion hole. And I would say, not likely. Not likely. How can things be adapted to that exist for microseconds? And only if it bound in a particular way. Now, this had to be made in anticipation of this, not because this existed. I digress. Now, let's take a look at some other things here. Near the last, we talked about zymogens. Zymogens, of course, are inactive enzyme precursors. Let's see here. And I dare not go. I'll go one more next time. All right, zymogens, inactive enzyme precursors. So we're done looking at the catalytic site, at the mechanism for serine proteases. Your textbook has a couple other mechanisms which we're going to skip. All right, so these zymogens, by definition, are inactive enzyme precursors. Extra residues distort. So the first blank is distort, first blank is inactive, second blank is distort, third blank is called substrate, fourth blank is temperature, fifth blank is pH. All right, so inactive enzyme precursors, extra residues of enzymes distort the active site, making it active until the extra residue is cleaved off. So, trypsin is synthesized by what organ? What organ in your body is trypsin synthesized by? Actually, it's actually not trypsin that's actually being synthesized. What is the inactive precursor for trypsin? Trypsinogen, exactly right. What is the organ that produces trypsinogen? Pancreas. Why does the pancreas produce trypsinogen instead of trypsin? Why does pancreas produce trypsinogen rather than trypsin? So it doesn't eat itself. That's correct. Is the pancreas the organ where digestion of food is supposed to occur? No, it's not. It's not designed, not physically designed for that. The intestinal tract is designed to handle 80, 90, 100 years, especially the stomach, of some of the most severe, harsh conditions that can exist within an animal. High pH, very high activity enzymes, and yet for years and years and years, none of that attacks our stomach lining or intestinal tract. It's designed for it. So it produces trypsinogen. It also produces another compound, another protein called trypsin inhibitor. So that trypsin inhibitor is designed to fit in the active site. Diseases occur in the pancreas when the levels of trypsin inhibitor decrease because even trypsinogen has a very small level of activity, but nevertheless, it's just enough that if it accidentally, without the trypsin inhibitor, it will begin to activate itself a few molecules at a time in the pancreas, and that is very serious. You get a disease called pancreatitis, and that's a very painful and can be deadly disease. It's a miserable disease to have pancreatitis. All right, well, so this trypsinogen is eventually secreted in the duodenum where other enzymes already exist. The trypsin then acts on itself. The trypsinogen cleaves off this one, two, three, four, five protein piece, this five amino acid piece that then causes the trypsinogen to fold properly, and you get trypsin, and then you're off and running. Chymotrypsinogen is a little more complicated. There's a variety of intramolecular bonds, disulfide bonds. So the chymotrypsinogen is synthesized like this, trypsin begins to cleave at least one part, then the chymotrypsin then acts on the rest of the parts, removes these two fragments, and this then begins to fold appropriately, and you get active chymotrypsin. Chymotrypsinogen, elastinogen, I guess that's it. Many of the digestive enzymes, especially the proteases, are synthesized in the inactive zymogen form. All right, factors affecting reaction rate. Of course, substrate concentration will speed it up. Temperature will speed it up. Reaches a max, then drops. Why does it reach a max and then drop? What's happening when it reaches a max and then drops? This is an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. It reaches a maximum in terms of temperature, maximum activity in terms of temperature, then begins to drop. What's happening? Denaturing or unfolding the enzyme. That's correct. pH changes can alter ionization, stay at the active site. pH changes can also denature or unfold the protein. And last, unique pH optimum exists for each unique enzyme, let's take a look. So, the enzymes that exist in your stomach, the trypsin and chymotrypsin and so on, what do you think their pH activity is, pH optimum is? 2, 3, 4, right. All right, so, and this is near our last one, and we'll get through this today. Do I have one more? Yes, there we go. Okay. Can you use enzymes to diagnose disease? Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Well, your grandfather's had a heart attack. We're not really sure how severe it is. We'll know in about 24 hours about how severe your grandfather's heart attack was. The first blank is zymogens. Turnover is the second blank. First blank is increased. Third blank is increased. Fourth blank is isozymes. Fifth and sixth blank is myocardial infarction. Myocardial infarction. Okay, are there enzymes in your blood plasma? Are there enzymes in your blood plasma? Somebody say yes. Are there enzymes in your blood plasma? Yes. Thank you very much. Most of them are supposed to be there. Hopefully, if you're disease-free, all of them are supposed to be there. Most of them occur because of zymogens that they're dealing with blood clotting and enzymes that appear with normal cell turnover. Are cells dying, ladies and gentlemen? Mm-hmm. And so when they die, what happens to their contents? They spill out into the intercellular fluid, interstitial fluid. Eventually, they end up in the plasma of the blood, and they get taken to the spleen and also the liver that captures those and recycles them, recycles the proteins and stuff. So, but can you have excessive tissue damage? Yeah, you can. If you, for example, how many of you here run a half marathon or a full marathon? Nobody? Boy, you guys are smarter than you look. I'm just teasing. One of these days, you're going to get the idea that I'm going to run. I've seen other people do it. I want to do it. I want to run a half marathon. And you train, and so you train enough that you feel pretty good, and you can run those 10-mile things without too much trouble. And so you do a half marathon, and you want to get a good time. So you kind of push yourself a little bit. The next couple days. What are your muscles like? Incredibly sore. Now, do you think the constant repetition over miles has destroyed some muscle tissue? Yeah, that's why you have pain. Destroyed a little bit. Therefore, if someone drew your blood after running a marathon, would they find some protein, some enzymes that are unique to muscles at a higher than normal level in your blood? Yeah, sure. And they'll go, you got elevated this, that, or the other, something. Have you just run a marathon? You'll go, yes, I just did. Oh, that's very nice. How was your time? This kind of thing. All right. Well, at any rate, well, you can do the same thing for diseases because there are specific kinds of enzymes, specific subgroups of enzymes that are unique to different tissues. For example, heart, liver, and skeletal muscle tissues. In your liver, there is an enzyme called alanine aminotransferase that's got a unique... Oh, I got to get done with it. It's got a unique thing. Now I can't. I will just have... I got a couple minutes later. I'm going to have to let you guys go. We'll finish this up, I guess, on tomorrow. Finish this up tomorrow. Although... And then that is, in fact, the last overhead. So, man, I hope to get to it, but I just ran too long.
This is my Father's word, and to my listening ears, all nature sings and around me rings the music of the sphere. This is my Father's world, the birds, the carols raise, the morning light, the lily white, the anemic pray. This is my Father's world, he shines in all that's fair. In rustling grass I hear him pass, he speaks to me everywhere. Speaks to me, speaks to me. This is my Father's world. Oh, let me never forget that though the wrong seems oft so strong, God is a ruler, yet God is a ruler, yet this is my Father's world. Shall be satisfied, and earth and heaven be one. Father's world.